I'm speaking with Roy Buchanan, the legendary guitarist, on the release of his newest album, My Babe, on Waterhouse Records, and I'll be talking with Roy about the new album and some of his thoughts about the past and what lies in store for him and rock and roll. Roy, it's good to have you here, and I'd like to start by mentioning that you've been playing blues and rock electric guitar just about longer than any white musician since way back in the mid-50s. And I want you to tell me a little bit about how you got started on guitar and what first influenced you to play guitar the way you did.
Well, I started playing guitar when I was 5 years old, and my father was a preacher, and they used to have what they call revivals. They'd have these about once a month. It meant that the black churches and the white churches would get together. That's the first time that I ever heard the blues, because if you listen to the black gospel music, you'll hear that's where the blues definitely came from. And I started playing blues like about the same time I started playing guitar, around 5 or 6 years old. And at that time, nobody even knew what the blues was except the black people. And this was before rock and roll came out. And when rock and roll first came in, I found that blues fit right into it, because the construction of the early rock and even rock today is based on blues changes, just a little more powerful beat and a little different a feel. And I left home like when I was about 15. I went on the road. It was 1955, and I got a group together called the Heartbeats, and I worked with other groups called, well, like for instance, Johnny Otis, the Johnny Otis Show. I don't know if you heard him or not. He's an old blues player and singer. And at that time, there was nobody except the blacks into blues, you know. I was the first white guy to do it, beyond a shadow of a doubt. If there was anybody else around, I sure never heard of them. And I traveled every state, even out of the country, to Japan, Hawaii, and Alaska, you know, back then. And I eventually came across, like, you know, the fuzz tone, the feedback, and all of that. And it was hard to get anybody to buy it back then, but I did play some blues that was released only in Europe. They wouldn't even release them in the United States because people didn't even know what it was. That's where a lot of the English guys had, you know, picked up on my playing.
Yeah, a lot of English musicians have mentioned you as an influence in their styles, right?
Like, well, there's been quite a few of them give me credit. Jimmy Page, I hear, give me credit. Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, just name a couple, three. And, well, Beck told me that he had all my albums dating back to the 50s, you know, and he said he'd been listening to me since then. And I've heard a lot of my licks come from across the waters, you know, that were definitely mine. And I'm really honored about the whole thing, you know. And what I'm reaching for now is a different plateau of music, you know.
Tell me about some of the early blues things, the labels, the songs.
Okay, I can't remember the name of some of the labels. A lot of the blues things, I can't even remember what half of them was called, but we did do one that we got real big over there called After Hours. We recorded that in 59. And we did a few things for Chess Records out of Chicago. I recorded My Babe in 57, and it was also released in the United States. Matter of fact, it was in the top 20. It's on the new album. Matter of fact, it's the name of the new album. It's a funny thing about My Babe, because Leonard and Phil Chess didn't actually want to release it, you know. And I said, well, put it on the B-side, you know. And so they did, and, that, you know, as soon as it came out, you know, all the disc jockeys flipped the record over, you know, and that became the hit, not the one that they had predicted would be the hit. I've always liked the song, My Babe. And I knew that back in the 50s it could have been a hit. Nobody wanted to buy it. That's the reason you put it on the B-side, you know, because I know that the public's not dumb, you know. I know that they would like the song if they got a chance to hear it, you know. Well, My Babe, there's a whole generation of new people out there, you know. And My Babe, like, should be heard again, you know. And I enjoy the song. I love the song and love to play it, you know. So that was the first thing we recorded when we went in the studio, was My Babe. And all that, when I heard, like, this new wave stuff, they call it, you know. It was a style of guitar that I first did on My Babe, you know, with the bass string, chugga, 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 you know. That was like a new wave sound back then. If you listen to the old record, you'll hear it, you know. So I just like did basically the same thing, like I said, and shortened it up again.
That's My Babe, title cut from Roy Buchanan's latest album. Some great guitar work on that cut. Tell me how that song has changed. I mean, it's been, what, 23 years since you recorded it?
It really hasn't changed all that much, except they have different recording techniques now. And the musicians nowadays are better. So, like, I've got the back, you know, the background for what I was really looking for. And there's a lot more energy into it now. Back then, you had no competition, like I say. So we just put it down and say, hey, that was great. Let's keep it, you know. Nowadays, you can't do that, you know. You have to work on it a little bit. But I'd say mostly what's made it better is that the musicianship, you know, of the sideman.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, because one of the constant criticisms of your albums and live performances has been your backup band not being able to keep up with your style. They said you never had a band that could complement what you do. And it seems you finally found the right combination. So mention who's in the band and how you found them all.
Well, we had an audition in New York. It was got together for me by NET, that's National Educational Television, in case you don't know. And I told them I wanted some of the best musicians that, you know, you could possibly get your hands on. So they got some guys together, you know. And I picked Paul Jacobs. He was the piano player, and he's a singer. He went to Juilliard, and he graduated from there. And he worked with Meat Loaf when they first started. He worked with Edgar Winter, and he's a great, great musician. And also we got Gordon Johnson on bass. He worked with people like Dizzy Gillespie, Maynard Ferguson, names I know that they're big jazz names, but I can't even recall half of them right now. And he also does a lot of studio work. And we got Danny Brubeck. Danny's a great, great drummer. He's been on the Carson show. He's worked with his dad on a lot of things. And
Roy, you've backed up a lot of musicians and had your own bands. The first one I remember is the Snake Stretchers from one of your earliest albums.
Yeah, I got the Snake Stretchers together in 1970. And was working at a place called the Crossroads at Peace Cross in Bladensburg, Maryland. And they were just beer-drinking buddies of mine, you know. And we were working out there, and I noticed that there was quite a few musicians that started coming in, you know, like Jerry Garcia, Dwayne Allman, people from the symphony, and all different kinds of people, you know. And they liked our sound. And
you had your own groups before that, or were you pretty much in other people's bands?
Well, actually, all through the years, I'd have my own group for a while. Then to make a little money, I'd work with somebody else, you know. That was the first group that I'd had since the early 60s, though. Like, the 60s almost passed me by, you know, as far as working with my own group, you know. I'd had my group, like, a time or two. It was hard to keep musicians back then because they'd usually freak out or too much acid, you know, that... How it goes, you know. Like, I back people like Fabian, Frankie Avalon, Eddie Cochran, Gene Vincent, you know, Dale Hawkins, and basically, like, whenever the rocks thing happened, or say the psychedelic thing in the 60s, they were doing basically what we'd already done. But like I say, a lot of times you couldn't get a recording company to buy that, you know. And when the Beatles came in, it opened the door, especially after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, because they were wide open for it, you know. And they fell for the Beatles' hook, line, and sinker, which was great for me because they got everybody into drugs and made them see a different side of life, you know. I'm not advertising drugs or anything, but it opened the door for me, you know. And it made people willing to listen to me, you know. It set the perfect thing up. It also set things up for Jimi Hendrix. And when I heard Hendrix, I said, great, because, like, I knew he had done everything that there was to do in the psychedelic thing, so they couldn't carry it any further, so they had to start searching around and coming back to the roots a little bit, but the roots would be sharpened up, you know. And like I said, it was just great for me because I'd just been laying back waiting for it, you know. I knew it was inevitable. It had to happen because I'd already been through it before, like I said, in the 50s, and I'd already investigated all the sounds and things, you know.
You mentioned Dale Hawkins, and I've heard an interesting story about you and the band, how they wanted you to play in their group back when they were the Hawks with Ronnie Hawkins.
I was working with Dale Hawkins, and we were playing Toronto, Canada, And Ronnie Hawkins, who's Dale's cousin, was working down the street. He had a group called the Hawks. And Ronnie used to come by every night and watch us play, you know. And he offered me a job in the band, the Hawks. And later on, they became the band, you know. And I told him I couldn't stay with him for long, you know. And he said, well, I know a guy that has potential on guitar. His name's Robbie Robinson, you know. He said, would you mind standing long enough to teach him how to play a little bit, you know? I said, no, you know, fine. So I stayed with him maybe a month, you know, and showed Robbie, you know, how to hold a guitar and so on. How to bend notes, how to rock. I was teaching him, like, you know, like the blues thing, how to use his fingers and, you know, how to back up somebody, you know, make them sound good, compliment the singer, you know, not be a guitar player and just, like, you know, take the show and, like, not know anything else, you know, because when you're a good musician, you got to know how to compliment other people, you know. You can't just go out there and every time and play lead all the time.
You were also asked to join the Rolling Stones at one time, too, when Brian Jones...
Yeah, when the guitar player died, the Rolling Stones, they approached the manager that I had, and they sounded me about playing guitar, you know. But at that particular time, I just got the Snake Stretchers together, and I was getting a little bit of publicity, and I really wasn't interested. Not only that, the guy that took the job did quit after 5 years of coke.
Well, did you meet with him?
No. The first time I met Mick Jagger was... I don't remember the name of the album that he was doing. Eric Clapton introduced me to him. I was in New York. I met him at Electric Ladyland, I think it was, yeah. He's a nice guy. Nothing, yeah, he really is. I mean, I like Keith Richards a lot. He's really a sweetheart.
Well, really, the one song that takes a stance on My Babe on a certain current social attitude is the song Lack of Funk, and the lyrics are about Keith
Mick Jagger, Keith and Mick. Well, at least, you know, it's probably the first time the Rolling Stones had a protest song written about them. They're usually on the other end of the stick, you know, writing protest songs about other people. And there were some people that wanted to change the words, you know, when Paul slammed him. I said, no, let's leave it just like it is, you know. And that's what we did. So, you know, even though it's a protest song, I like it anyway.
You produce My Babe. It's the first time you've produced your own album, I believe. Why did you decide that it was finally time to do it yourself? I mean, was there any one thing? You've had a history of being recorded by a lot of great producers.
Arif Martin, Stanley Clark, Ed Freeman, and Pete Siegel, and, you know, like a lot of the heavy guys. But I feel that, you know, they don't know me. They come, you know, around, and they're supposed to know me in just a few days. Well, I know me better than they do because I've lived with me longer. You know what I mean? And, like, I've always, you know, like, wanted to produce my own album, but they always said, you know, Buzz Buchanan know about producing. All he knows how to do is play guitar. And I keep on saying, you know, like, I want to produce my own album so nobody would listen to me. And I was going through my income tax receipts, and I found a little card in there. It said Waterhouse Records, and that's unusual because usually I'd, you know, when anybody give me a recording card, you know, as soon as they left, I'd drop it in the trash, you know. But I had a feeling about this one, so I called up, you know, and Gary Marks, you know, I explained to him what I wanted to do, and he said, fine, you know. He said, that sounds great, you know. He said, have you done anything about it yet? I said, well, I got, you know, almost half an album completed, you know, so if you want to hear the things, come on down, you know. So he flew down to my place in Virginia, and he listened to the tapes, and he said, we'll do it your way, you know. So I said, great, Gary, you know, let's get it together, you know. And we just completed the album, and like, it's definitely the best thing I've ever recorded.
You did it at the record plant, right, in New York?
Did it at the record plant in New York. Shelly Yakis owns it, and he gave me a discount. And used Dave Thorner as the engineer, the great engineer. And the reason I picked that place is because I had recorded there before, and I knew that if, you know, they knew the sound that I wanted, so all I'd have to do is just explain to them and, you know, let them go at it. So I'd go out in the control booth and tell them what I wanted, and I'd go back in the studio and play it. That's the way that Hendrix did it, too.
On the new album, you've got what some people might think is a strange song for a rock album called Secret Love.
Secret Love. That's always been a song that I liked. It was recorded first by Doris Day. It was from a movie. And I learned that song, like, God, I must have been 9 or 10 years old. It was one of the first songs I learned. You know, and through the years, like, I played it here and there. It was like the same thing as Sweet Dreams, you know, like, it was always in the back of my head, you know. And I'd asked them once or twice, like, when I was on Atlantic Records, to let me record a song. And, you know, I'd mention the name Doris Day, they'd say, nay, no. they said, you know, Doris Day number, you know, she's James Garner's girl, right? Or something like that, you know. But anyway, when I recorded it, you know, I don't think they're going to laugh at it anymore.
Roy Buchanan on guitar from the new album. Roy, do you think anything is going to radically change the sound of rock and roll as we know it today?
Yeah, a lot of people think that the synthesizer guitar is going to, like, take over, and rock and roll is going to, you know, get people up in arms again, like protest and all that. It's not going to happen. Because, first of all, they're going to use, if the synthesizer comes in, they're going to use it for, like, decoration, you know. They're not going to use it as strictly lead all the time because it does get boring. And not only that, when you synthesize a guitar, you've made another instrument. And if you're going to synthesize, use a synthesizer, you know. Get your avatar and do it on keyboards because it has more range, it's more versatile. You know, you can reach out more with it. I think rock and roll. It's going to stay rock and roll. It's going to be the hard beat. And it's going to, you know, like... It's going to take somebody with a little different approach, a little energy, and somebody that believes in it, you know, to keep it going, you know, because there's plenty in rock that hasn't been played. I disagree with Mick Jagger, and I also disagree with Billy Joel, because he said that rock was not an art form. Well, it is an art form, or the Beatles proved that. Mick Jagger says rock and roll is through, there's nothing left to play. Well, he's wrong, because in the 50s, I heard the same thing. You know, they said there's nothing left to play. It's because they don't know what else to do. They've run out themselves. But that doesn't mean rock and roll's through. To me, it's just starting. It just takes somebody with a little bit of brain to put it together, you know, and love it and stick with it, you know, apply a little energy.
You'll settle for your old 53 Telecaster, right? That guitar is on the cover of the new album. Do you still play that and take it on the road?
No. The reason I quit even taking my guitar on the road was because I was... robbed 3 times, you know, and it just streak of luck that I, you know, for the first time they tied my whole band up. They had guns and pistol whooped the guys, you know, and I'd left about maybe 20 minutes early, 15, 20 minutes earlier, you know, and then another time they broke into my room, took the door off, you know, but as usual I kept my guitar with me, not in the room, and then they didn't even bother with my clothes or anything, radios, you know, they were just after my guitar. And the last time was up in New York, you know. Guy just tried to take it off of me, you know. Well, he's going to have a little trouble because I think it can also be used as a swinging weapon.
That kind of excitement you don't need. You've covered a lot of territory in this interview about your past. And...
I think I just about covers it, you know. I would like to tell everybody, though, you know, that I appreciate, you know, them sticking by me for all these years, you know, because without nobody to listen to music, there is no music. It's like a tree that falls in the forest. If there's nobody to hear it, it doesn't happen, you know. No sound.
Is My Babe going to be the album to bring Roy Buchanan commercial success?
Commercial success doesn't really mean a lot to me, because for a lot of reasons. I'll give you one example. I never cared about commercial success, but the thing of it is, I've seen musicians come and go, and I mean big ones, like, you know, Peter Frampton. You know, there was a time when Peter Frampton used to open for me. Then he got so big that he wanted me to open for him. I wouldn't do it, but he wanted me to. And just a few months ago, he wants to open for me again. You know, these people don't want to see him, you know.
Yeah.
But my leverage is always like being the same, you know. Those people, they like a religious experience, you know.
Yeah.
I don't really care about being like a top 40 thing. I mean, really not, you know. If it happened, you know, like, I wouldn't bitch about it. It'd be great, you know. I really just want to make good rock and roll music, you know. And that's what I want to put on my albums, is good rock and roll music. I'll be playing rock and roll when they put me away. Because, like, you know, I think rock and roll, you know. Blues and rock and roll fit together. When I'm thinking music, it is rock and roll, you know. I can't ever see me quitting playing rock and roll. You know, I'll play it till they get sick of me.
Roy Buchanan, a rock and roll doctor. Certainly a rock and roll blues legend with some good thoughts and good music. Thank you, Roy.